Well, I guess we're on. Hare Krishna, everyone. And welcome to our, I don't know what this is now. This must be about our sixth or seventh session. Seventh. Oh, yeah. This is our seventh session discussing devotee relationships. And tonight, we have someone who may look familiar to you. And I'll tell you why he may look familiar to you. Because if you've ever seen the videos of Srila Prabhupada's life, you have seen Kalyupani, who starred as the head of the British Raj, it seems, who played the part of a very unsympathetic, diplomatic, prejudiced Britisher who thought the Indians were savages and or less than savages and needed to be reformed and educated in Western culture and Western education. So if you recognize, if you don't recognize, and then if you go and watch the videos of the earlier ones, then you will see him there, because he's an excellent actor and also a musician. So I want to welcome Kalyupani. Let's give him a big round of applause. So we decided we wanted to start speaking from the Nectar of Instruction, Gadati Pratiganati, the six exchanges of love, giving and sharing and revealing one's mind and confidence, Yadati Pratiganati, Guyam Akati Prachiti, and then what's the other one?
Bhunkte Bhojayati Chayiva, Sadvida Pratilakshanam.
The giving prasad?
Yeah, that's Bhunkte Bhojayati is giving prasad, the Dati Pratiganati is giving gifts and receiving gifts. And Guyam Akyati Prishyati means revealing the mind and inquiring confidentially.
So should we give them our mailing address so they can send us all gifts? So before we, if you want our mailing address, just let us know. So before we start, I had some foundational ideas, foundational principles I'd like to discuss that I've been thinking about this week. And one of the principles relates to what we a little bit to what we talked about last week. If you were with us last week we were talking about introspection, looking at ourselves rather than looking at others' faults. And so we have that tendency, it's easier to see others' faults than our own. But being objective about ourselves is important in a relationship, because often the other person is not at fault. We're actually at fault and we don't want to admit that. Or we're reacting to someone else's fault in a negative way. So I was thinking this week that as devotees, one of the duties we have is to help elevate the consciousness of the world, help elevate other people's consciousness. And generally, when we think of elevating other people's consciousness, we think of preaching, teaching them. And often, when we teach people, we point out their faults. That's one of the duties of the guru, is to point out a person's fault or their weakness or how they're an illusion, how they're being misguided. And sometimes we may think if we do that well, then we've done our duty. But speaking is only part of it. But more important is the person who is speaking, what their realization is. Because we communicate realization just by our presence, not just by what we say, but with the realization that comes with it and the consciousness behind what we say. So my thought this week was that there's an irony in thinking we don't have to internalize Krishna consciousness to give it. Or the irony is more thinking that we can elevate the consciousness of the world without elevating our own consciousness. So we may hold on, we may say, well, this is the way I am. I don't get along with certain people, or I tend to be critical, or whatever it is. And this is just the way I am. And it's ironical or paradoxical to think that we can be that way and think we're going to influence people to be some other way than we are. And so Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught that in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. And I want to read a few things Prabhupada said. The verse is, Apani Achari Bhakti Shikainu Sabare. And Prabhupada, one way he explains that is one cannot teach unless he behaves the same way, or he behaves as he teaches. But the actual That's a paraphrase of the actual translation. Unless one practices devotional service himself, he cannot teach it to others. The conclusion is indeed confirmed throughout the Gita and Bhagavatam. So it's, in a sense, hypocritical to think that we can teach something which we don't exemplify, at least to some degree. And here's another quote. This is from Srila Bhaktisiddhanta. I really like this. Preaching without proper conduct, conduct falls within the category of karma. Is that interesting? Hmm. Preaching without proper conduct falls within the category of karma. Wow. Mundane activity. So you wouldn't think preaching is mundane activity. And here Srila Bhaktisiddhanta is saying it becomes mundane if we're not living what we're preaching. We become hypocrites, bogus sadhus. Without criticizing the nature of others, one should correct oneself. This is my personal instruction. So that was my point, that when we preach, there's a tendency, or when we tell others about Krishna, there's a tendency to point out the ignorance that they're in, or the ignorance the world is in, or what's wrong with the world and what's wrong with people, how people are in Maya. And that can create a kind of a propensity for us to just look at how everyone's in Maya and not reflect on our own Maya. So I think this exemplifies that point. Without criticizing the nature of others. Okay, we might point out, but we're not meant to criticize the nature of others. Maybe the ignorance. Hate the sin, not the sinner. And then the other thing...
Can I give a little personal example of that?
Go ahead, yeah.
I was sitting in a house program the other day, and the speaker was sitting on the floor or on a cushion, and opposite him there were several people sitting on a settee raised higher, and I was actually sitting on a chair like I am now on the other side of the room, and I was sitting there like I was looking at these people and thinking, look at these people, they're all sitting higher than the speaker, and I was on exactly the same level. I caught myself out.
That's the the needle is, you know, the strainer is criticizing the needle, that the needle has a hole in it. Yeah. The strainer has many holes in it, and he's criticizing, oh, look at you, needle, you have a hole. So here's a nice statement. It's from Srila Bhaktisiddhanta. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta says, look within. Amend yourself rather than pry into the frailties of others. So this was a big theme with Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, the theme of introspection, looking at yourself. And he also used the word self-deception many, many times in his lectures and his teachings. And in relation to self-deception, he often made reference to being motivated to serve Krishna by the desire to be recognized, or the desire to gain something, particularly wealth, or gain something from others. So reputation would be something you gain from others as well. So he often spoke to devotees to be aware of their motives. And he told a story. There was a man, you know, who had a business, and everyone he hired quit because he was so hard on them. So his friend said, well, what you should do is, I think these were domestic servants, and they always quit. He said, what you should do is hire a person and feed them the highest quality rice you have with ghee every day for 6 months before they even start working. And he didn't understand why. And the man said, you'll understand, just do it. Let him eat it for 6 months before you put him to work. So he fed this man 6 months of fine quality rice, better than the man could ever get, and ghee, because the man was poor, so he couldn't afford good rice and he couldn't afford ghee. So then after 6 months, he started working. And then he was very hard on this man, and the man left. And then very shortly after, the man came back. And he said, why did you come back? He said, because I'm so attached to the rice and the ghee. I can't live without it. And so Bhaktisiddhanta, he said, the rice and the ghee is like personal motivation, that we become attached to being, to the honor or whatever it is we get, anything material we could possibly get from doing devotional service, we become attached to that, and then we serve for that reason.
There's one purport, very nice purport, in the Gundicha Marjana section of Chaitanya Charitamrita, where Prabhupada explains how someone may give up fruitive work and take up devotional service. But if, you know, the subtle form of fruitive intention remains, then that may again become manifest in his devotional service in the form of, you know, let me become known as a great devotee. And, I can personally, I feel this is a major feature of my so-called spiritual life. And sometimes, you know, I think that, in fact, I have stopped speaking for long periods of time, I mean years, stopped giving class, because I can see in myself that my ability to speak the philosophy far exceeds my ability to put it into practice in my life. So, that's not nice.
Yeah, I was just discussing this with some devotees on the internet, and he made the same point. He said, it's very easy to speak the philosophy, but it's difficult to live according to the philosophy. So I like the meditation of just seeing how hypocritical we can be in thinking that we don't have to be the change that we want to see in the world, that we just expect others to be Krishna conscious, and we'll preach to them to be Krishna conscious, and we don't think we have to. And it is a big problem. There's a lot of us who are dwelling on very petty lower levels of consciousness, of being extremely critical or envious or resentful, and at the same time practicing bhakti, but not really dealing with those weeds and not really understanding how that affects people around us, and how that's such a great impediment to helping others. So Bhakti Siddhanta's instructions are so nice, because he's always saying, look at yourself, work with yourself, look at your motives. And I think one of the points he's making is that if you're looking at other people's motives, it's really a lack of your own willingness to look at your own. Because why do we need to be so concerned about other people's motives, or what we think are their motives, which may not even be their motives? And often what we think are their motives are our motives. And that's why we think they're their motives, because we understand those motives.
Yeah.
So I got this email today, and in the email it said, this is what it said. It said, I challenge you to make your life a masterpiece. I challenge you to join the ranks of those people who live what they teach, who walk their talk. I challenge you. I just got challenged. I challenge you to live what you teach. So that some of you out there might be saying, well, I don't, you know, really, I'm not really a preacher, I'm not really a teacher, but still we're talking about living Krishna conscious, living what you believe. If you're not a teacher per se, then it's living what you believe, what you have faith in. And if you have children, then you're a teacher, for sure. And in educational theory, in raising children, what's the theory? The theory is what you do is what they learn, not what you say. And we can apply that to spreading Krishna consciousness. And there's a story. Srila Prabhupada asked one devotee to go preach in Bengal. And then Prabhupada told him, he said, but Prabhupada, I don't speak Bengali. And Prabhupada said, that's okay. They're not interested in what you say, they're interested in what you do. They want to see you, how you're acting. So that's, you know the saying, your actions speak so loud I can't hear what you're saying. So I just wanted to bring this up as a foundational principle. I want to read this again. Unless one practices devotional service, he cannot teach it to others. So that's the real power, is in what's in our own heart. And even if we're not teaching, what is in our heart affects other people. We should know that. And so if we want to elevate the consciousness of the world, then we have to be the conscious elevation we want to be. So we want to see in the world. So that's our foundation for tonight. You're all welcome. Prema Sindhu, I haven't seen you in a few weeks. Welcome. And Mother Janice. And Seva Kanos. Wow. And Tommy. So, a lot of newcomers. And Bhatta Patrick, an old faithful. And Kremlin again. Namaste, Kremlin. You want to take part in this discussion, please feel free. So we're going to talk about giving gifts and receiving gifts. And I think one thing which is very important, and I've been in this position as a just have by default, I've been in this position because I joined ISKCON so early in the movement. So by default, I became a senior devotee. This doesn't mean I'm more advanced or anything. I just became senior just because I joined when I was young and the movement was young. And so one of the services that senior devotees have, and you may not think this is a service, but it actually is a service and sometimes a difficult service, is to accept service. And so when we talk about gifts, gifts just don't mean physical things, but also offering service to someone is a gift. In fact, I just heard something today and said, this lady suggested, she said, you know, you don't have to, she said, our culture is so overconsumed with things. She said, you don't always have to give things to people when you want to offer them a gift. You could go over to the house and say, I want to offer you 3 hours of help today in your garden. You could actually render service. You know, you could offer them some service. So as an older devotee, one of the services we have is to accept service. And also one of the services we have is to accept honor. People like to honor us. Oh, you're a Prabhupada disciple. Some devotees, if they just find out we're a Prabhupada disciple, that automatically they'll want to honor and worship us, because in many countries in the world, there are very few Prabhupada disciples. So I may go to some remote country, and that's a very important thing for them. And so for us, oftentimes it's austere because we don't feel qualified to accept the worship. But that's part of, you know, it says accepting gifts. So you're not just giving, but accepting is a, it's a service, you know. And of course, we accept and then we offer, we want to offer that to Krishna. But glorifying devotee is service, and it's recommended in Shastra. And to there's a verse, Mahaprabhu spoke this to Sanatana Goswami, he said, to glorify the devotee is perfection of speech. So it's a service, so for us to glorify devotees, and as older devotees, if you're older than someone else, for them to allow them to glorify you. And what I mean by allowing them to serve and glorify you is if they do that, our natural tendency is to say, what's our natural tendency to say? No, I don't deserve that. And I'm not worthy of your glory, and you don't have to serve me, and I'm just a fallen soul. But that's actually not the proper way to take service. But because it's like I offer Kalyapani a gift. No, I'm not worthy of the gift. And I spent the whole day looking for the perfect gift, and I know it's really what he likes. And he says, no, I can't take it because I'm not worthy of this. And then I feel upset. And I spent so much time finding the perfect gift, and now he doesn't want to accept it. So we as a senior, if you're a senior to someone and they offer you service or glorification or gifts or whatever, you should wholeheartedly welcome it. And if they offer you some physical gift, even it's, you know, a lot of gurus, they get a lot of socks and sweaters, right? If you ever become a guru, then before you become a guru, throw away all your socks and sweaters, because you're going to get a lot, especially around your first Vyasa Puja day. You'll get a lot of socks and sweaters. So if you're a guru and you get your 45th pair of socks in 1 year, then don't tell your disciple, oh no, more socks? You know, you always want to accept things wholeheartedly.
Well, my realization on that is that you know, these giving gifts, because it's with devotees that we should make friends. Devotees are suitable repositories for our friendship, not other people. One should not. So, you know, whatever we want to give, of course we can encourage non-devotees, like if we have family, you know, there may be some gifts or something there, but the real heartfelt business goes on with the devotees, and whatever we want to give or receive. And giving also means giving ourselves, you know, not pretending to be someone we're not.
That's an interesting gift. Give yourself as you are. You know, I read an interesting thing that, and maybe you can relate to this, or some of you can relate to this, There's a psychologist who said this, and it was his experience from doing workshops, that people feel they're afraid or they're reluctant to present themselves as they are because they feel they won't be accepted by others. So they put on a facade to be accepted. But actually the opposite is true. Because when we put on a facade, people don't like that. And they can see that. When we're actually just real, what you see is what you get, that people accept and they appreciate. So it's a good point in terms of relationships to be what you are, and also for bhakti to not be a pretentious devotee. And why would we? I mean, obviously another reason to be pretentious is just to get honor. But as I pointed out, sometimes it's just to get affection. We want to be accepted. And in my experience is that really acceptance comes from being real, and being real is a sign of humility, that we're not trying to portray any kind of false image to get to trick people in some way. So that's an excellent point. Give yourself as you are, which also is how we reveal our mind. Because how can we reveal our mind openly and honestly if we're being pretentious? So I think also along that line is the idea of finding people you trust and you feel comfortable with, so you'll naturally don't need to be pretentious. You know, perhaps sometimes we think we need to be pretentious to impress people so they'll like us. But to have at least some close relationships with people who you can just be who you are and they just accept you as you are, and it's okay to be who you are. And there was another point I hadn't touched on. I touched on briefly, but I forgot to elaborate on it more, and I think it's essential also that sometimes we are a certain way because that's who we are. We're conditioned, and we're works in progress, and we're trying to change. And we can hit a wall at some point and just think, this is who I am. I can't change beyond this. And then we come to these walls or barriers where we might say, well, I'm just a critical person. That's who I am. That's what I'm like. That's my nature. I see I'm more critical or more sarcastic than other people. And the most dangerous thing is when we believe that that's who we are. That's our identity. I mean, that's a strange identity to have, isn't it? If you think about it. Well, what's your identity? My eternal identity is to be critical of others. That's who I am. But that's really what we're saying, isn't it? When we're saying I can't change, I'm a critical person, or whatever kind of person I am, we're just saying that's my identity. And obviously that's not my identity, but that identity is reinforced by the belief that that's my identity. That's who I am. So it's so important in developing relationships to understand that we are pliable and we can improve, because a lot of times it's difficult. We real run into this critical tendency, and then we'll think it's just the way I am, and then that can destroy relationships. Or yeah,
if we read Prabhupada's books, then we can come to understand what is anartha. Having read Prabhupada's books, we look at ourselves and we can understand that certain characteristics that I have are not really wanted. And then if we can recognize them, like when I heard from the Chaitanya Charitamrita, like I just said, about wanting to be a devotee, to be an advanced devotee, known as an advanced devotee. When I heard that, I just immediately, I kind of caught myself out that this is a major part of my, you know, spiritual program, is to become a big devotee. I recognize it. It's not as if I, you know, did anything particular to try and remove it, but I recognized it. And that, you know, that's a first major step, because recognizing it puts it outside of me. I know that it's something, right. It's an anartha, which may also be applicable to many people, because it's a feature of Maya's program. So, you know, and also, you know, the only thing we can do is change ourselves, really. Can't change, that's a nice way to look at things, that I can't actually change anything. You know, the universe is as the universe is. The only thing that's available to me for change is myself.
And that will have a greater change on others.
Yeah.
There's another nice point in relation to what you just made. And this is a common situation that we all run into, that we'll hear something either in a class or we'll read it or even in a discussion with another devotee. And it will affect us for 3 days, a week, maybe 2 weeks. And then we go back. Have any of you had that experience out there? I think that's a rhetorical question. I think the answer is yes, we all. We all have that experience, right? We hear something and then a few weeks later, it kind of dissolves. Or we get some realization sometimes. And a few weeks later, we can't even remember what the realization was, although at the time it was very profound and it was also motivating us for a few days or a few weeks to think or act in a particular way. One of the problems, and you just addressed it here, is getting outside of yourself. So when we learn something, that's only one stage of learning. That's gathering. That's information. Okay, here's information. And so we hear something and then we walk out with information, and you can do anything you want with information. And often when we're motivated only for a few days or a week or so, it just means we're on the information level. It was just, it hit us in a deep way. It was information. It's in our head. It was like it came to the forefront of our head because it was, we felt it was profound, or it related to us in a profound way. And then because it's only information, that information didn't enter any, it didn't enter within our life. So the next level is when you understand something, you examine it and how it relates to you. You look at it. Okay, here, I just learned this. Okay, I'm learning. For example, for tonight, we've already learned a few things. So let's say if we take one example, that when somebody offers you something, you should accept it. You shouldn't reject it. That's your service. So I say, okay, so how does that apply? How has that applied in the past? How have I failed perhaps to apply it? How could I apply it in the present? So you start to examine, you know, you look at it, you reflect. That's a reflection stage. And then you go to another stage where you begin to think, well, how could I put that into practice? And so you're like looking, you're looking at yourself and you're looking at this thing that Prabhupada said, and you're examining it and saying, and in your examination you start to realize this is a big platform for Maya to work on us, and it's a real problem for me. So you've examined it. So now how can I deal with it? So the next stage is, how can I deal with that? And so one of the things you said is, well, you decided you didn't want to give class because you felt it was kind of using that as a platform to get some honor or draw attention to yourself. So you're taking it from one level to another, and then associating with devotees who have that quality. So by associating with them, you can learn more how to imbibe it. So we often just go through that first level. Like when I do my seminars, I make sure we go through all these levels. We spend a whole day or two. So I want people to get something, whether it's japa or forgiveness, whatever we're talking about, you actually get it. You know, how are we going to apply this in our life? How do you understand it affecting you? And then how will you apply it? And then looking at how you apply it in the long run. Is there anything that's going to block you from consistently doing that? So that's just a general, it's an important point for anything we're going to learn. So now we talked first about receiving. So now we can talk about giving. And one of the things that's very interesting is I was at the temple tonight before I came here, and there was a lecture playing, and Prabhupada quoted this verse. And I thought, we should talk about this verse. And then Kalyapani had come and he had said, you know, we should talk about this verse. And that's why we're talking about it. And one of the things that Prabhupada said, he said, relationships are meant for developing love. So that's interesting, relationships. So let's use that now as a foundation to build upon this whole discussion, that our relationships are meant to develop love. And when, you know, I think, you know, in our culture, when we talk about love, we kind of reserve it for a few people. Like, you know, it's my brother, my sister, my immediate family. And we don't really think about, you know, the further we extend it out, the less I think we think of love, or just, you know, having affection for someone like a stranger. That's a really alien idea. But at least the concept that I think Prabhupada's talking about here is within the devotional circles, devotees or people becoming devotees, congregation, when he talks about these exchanges, he's talking about these are loving exchanges. This is what love means. Love is what you do. What do they say? Love is what love is what as what love does. So this is what love does. So,
and that's the last line of the verse from Upadeshamrita, is that these are the six loving exchanges,
right,
with devotees.
So it's a nice meditation. Like, okay, this is what we're talking about here in devotion. You know, this is our goal. We've been talking about relationships, and we're talking about good relationships. You know, we want good relationships with the devotees. So here, Prabhupada's defining a good relationship as a loving relationship. So if we set that as our goal, in a sense, it creates more of an impetus, and it's easier to develop a good relationship if you're going for a loving relationship. If you're just going for a good relationship, you may end up with a bad relationship. But if you're going for a loving relationship, at least you'll end up with a good one, if not a loving relationship. So, okay, so now we're back onto giving. So what are we supposed to give? How does that work? What do we give devotees? Do we give them money? Is that what is meant here? I mean, it could be. It's not impossible.
Actually, it's difficult. I find it difficult to know what to give to devotees. You know, give a bead bag or a dhoti. Giving to devotees, you know, it really helps the relationship. I mean, if someone gives me something, you know, it means that he's... Because Westerners, especially men, you know, we're kind of hard and, you know, we don't do things lovingly. That's right. Lovingly so much. So, you know, if someone makes an effort and gives me something, I know that, you know, he's really becoming vulnerable and to me, and really... He's really... You know, he's leading the way. He's leading the way for me to soften up and, you know, become a bit more real and, you know, enter into the softness of devotional relationships.
Yeah.
So it would mean that, you know, just knowing that, just looking for an opportunity, always looking for an opportunity to give someone something. You know, ears open for something that someone needs. And it'll come, you know, I think... If you want to do that, the opportunity will come and the intelligence will come, how to apply it, when and where.
You know, there's a lot of times I look at devotees' lives and I see how much they have to do and how little time they have. And sometimes I think it'd be, as I mentioned before, just a great gift to ask them, do you need any help doing anything? You know, because I bet any person you ask that, if they thought about it for a moment, they'd say, yeah, I have this thing and I really need help with it. I don't know how to do it, or I just don't have time to do it. And that would really be wonderful if you could help me. Mm-hmm. And it's just one way of looking at how we could serve another devotee, just being conscious of, well, maybe there's something they need. That, being aware, kind of being in their world. And I really like that point you made about when a devotee comes to offer you something, he's really showing that he wants to deepen the relationship and he's showing his affection. Or vice versa, as you said, that we can show our affection, and it's kind of it's like we're saying, can I open the door to a deeper relationship? So yeah. It's very, very sweet.
And Mahaprasad that's a good thing to give. There are many forms of Mahaprasad, you know, there's flowers or garlands or the food that's offered to Krishna. And if you look at Chaitanya Charitamrita, that's what, when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was in Jagannath Puri, that's what the devotees would do. They would invite him to their house and then give him Mahaprasad of Lord Jagannath. They would go out and get the Mahaprasad of Lord Jagannath and then offer that to the Lord. And that's, you know, material things, devotees are not so attached to material things, so that's why gift giving is difficult. But Maha Prasad is, you know, that's really not difficult at all. And it's the ideal gift, actually, because it's Krishna. And, you know, it's a humble thing to give, and it's something that a devotee will fully accept immediately. And we have to know how to get it. You know, a garland immediately should be put on. It should not be put aside. It immediately should be honored. Food should immediately be honored, at least one grain of the Maha Prasad. If we say, okay, I'll take it later, that's not nice, because Krishna has come. So you can go to the temple, get some Maha Prasad, which lasts, and carry it around and look for devotees to give it to, and it's very nice. You know, they'll love you for it, and you'll feel good.
Or when you go to India, you know, bring back Jamuna water, Ganga water,
yeah,
dust from Braj, and that's a wonderful gift.
Yeah.
Giving from the heart. Giving is an expression of the heart. My wife was telling me today that love exists within the heart. It doesn't exist within the mind. And if it exists within the mind, it's not love. It's only, you might think you love, but you don't really. Because this is where love, this is the seat of emotion, is within the heart. And that's where we connect. And it's so nice to practice that with devotees, because that's what bhakti is about. It's the softening of the heart. And Prabhupada uses that word a lot, softening the heart.
Mm.
And he said in higher stages of bhakti, the heart actually melts. And in lower stages of bhakti, lower stages of bhakti, we have the example from Bhagavatam that the heart is steel framed. I don't know the exact Sanskrit if it was actually steel, but Prabhupada translated it as steel framed. It's hard. And that there's also another example. The heart is soft like gold or soft like butter, and it melts. Gold is a soft metal. So when it heats up with bhakti, then it melts. And so there is, there's so much we can do to melt the heart, and there's so much we can do to harden the heart.
Mm.
And again, if we go back to that point, when our heart is soft, it will also soften the others' hearts.
Yeah.
And when it's hard, it tends to harden others' hearts. We'll make other people offensive or defensive.
These six practices, they are the sadhana of loving relationships. So, and it's a fact that if we don't practice this, you know, if you never approach someone, you never give them anything, you never ask them questions, reveal your mind, or then the mind will tell you so many things about this person. It'll find so many superficial things. And if you do the sadhana, you know, you just give a gift or talk to them or something, then it's amazing how just like that, your attitude towards them can completely change, and you defeat your mind, and you see them actually as they are. You know, you find the nice devotional side of them immediately. I'm just realizing that this is the sadhana of loving relationships. These exchanges, so important.
And you are just saying, I was thinking as you were talking about two things. One, if you're trying to give somebody something, you're trying to offer whatever it is you're offering, and you're saying that it defeats the mind, because as you're opening your heart to someone, then number one, you couldn't do that and maintain your critical mentality, because they're contradictory. You can only really operate on one. You can't really love and hate someone at the same time. I mean, unless you're really close to them, like married to them, then sometimes that happens. But in general, in ordinary relationships with friends, if we don't like them, we don't want to serve them. If we want to serve them, then we don't think about not liking them. So it's kind of a medicine. You know, it's the sadhana of loving relationships. It's the medicine to cure any kind of critical or envious mentality. And also another thing I was thinking when you were saying how something that I do, there's two things that I do in terms of giving these gifts. One thing I do is just listen. I'll see somebody and I'll ask them, how's it going? And just let them talk, and I don't say anything. And just kind of let them kind of say what they need to say, because oftentimes they need to say something and they haven't told it to anybody. They need to just let it out off their chest or off their mind and just say, you know, what they're feeling or what's going on for them. So that's also a service, just to be listened, just to be a set of ears and an attentive listener and let them speak. And another thing that I think is a really great gift, and as I think if we all do this, then our movement's going to be a much better movement. And that is to be encouraging, to find something positive about somebody and then encourage them. It could be anything. It could be just a devotee sweeping the temple room floor, and you just go up to them and you can just say, thank you for doing that. That's really nice. Or, I watched you sweep the floor and you're really meticulous, and I was really inspired by how well you did that. And I just really appreciate that you're doing that. And I think, or I just think it's so nice that you do that. Whatever it is, because we all need to be encouraged. You know, we all want to know that what we're doing makes a difference. It has value for others, and so to say that can be very important for people. And sometimes I notice the devotees have talents that they're not using. They may not even be aware of them. And I'll see them do something, and I'll go up to them and say, have you ever thought of doing this? Because you're really good at it. And they'll either say, no, I haven't, but that's interesting. Or they might say, actually, I have. And that was really encouraging that you said that. So I think that's a wonderful service. You know, I think it's a wonderful gift, the gift of encouragement, because often, you know, we may not feel appreciated, and that can raise doubts in our mind about the validity of what we're doing or the value of our own existence. And it's very powerful. I know I like to sing, I like to play music. And once my wife said to me years ago, when we're in the early years of marriage, she said, do you have a better voice than anybody? Or something like that. She said, you sing. Nobody sings as good as you. She just said that, like, to me. You know? And it wasn't that my ego needed that, but the result was, I remember right after she said that, that my singing improved like 300%, just because she said that. You know, I was just like, really? I'm like the best singer? Well, I guess I have to sing like I'm the best singer. So, you know, something as simple as a little bit of encouragement can help somebody improve. And my understanding of one of the biggest problems, or the most common problem for most people, maybe not everyone, but for most people, is some sort of lack of self-confidence or lack of confidence in themselves. Even people who are good at something, you'd be surprised to know they don't think they're good at it. They don't always think they're good at it. Obviously, some people know they're good and think they're good, but some people are good and they say, no, I'm not really that good. And I'm sometimes in a state of shock when they say that. It's like, you know, how can they say that? So I think it's a valuable service to, you know, and especially for kids, to encourage them. You see them say something, oh, I saw you doing this. You must be. I can tell you're really good at that. You know, I saw you solve that problem. I can tell you really have a good brain for solving problems. You know, let me tell you, because I know what I'm talking about. When I see a kid solve a problem, I know they're special. So I just want you to know you're special. Something like that.
Devotees can devotees have a really rare gift that they can give people, and that is this acceptance. Because generally, when one approaches someone, you don't find the space where you can be yourself, you know, where you can just be accepted, because people have they're putting out so many things. Usually you approach someone, you say a couple of lines, and then they'll talk for half an hour expounding on those two lines. But devotees, because they've deeply accepted their own kind of fallen nature, and devotees, you know, they genuinely think themselves more fallen than the most fallen. So, you know, devotees can give that acceptance to people. Even, you know, that's a drunk. I've seen it, that a drunk person is looking for a fight. But when they come up to a devotee, the devotee doesn't feel that he's better than the drunk. So I've seen it often, that the drunk gets shocked in the association of a devotee, because he's fine, you know. He's a rotten drunk, but he's fine in the company of this person. So that's a really, you know, and it's just, and to give person an ear to, like you were saying, let them speak what they want to speak. That's a really wonderful gift, which, you know, again, it'll shock people. And actually, there were these two Christian saints. I read about this a long time ago. They were hermits. They lived in the desert in a cave in different places, and they both had the same effect on people. They would completely purify and relieve people, but one of them, you walk into his cave and he would just preach, and you'd come out thinking, wow, that was incredible. And the other one, you walk into his cave and he would be completely silent, and he would just, people would just, this is actually, this is real, it's true. People would just talk and talk, and he wouldn't say a word. And at the end, people would come out thinking, wow, that was really, really wonderful. He really helped me. You know, thank you so much. Just by, you know, silent understanding, that's a serious gift.
So we can go into the next one. And I think we already touched on it a little bit, which is revealing your mind and confidence. And what was the other part of that? Accepting?
Inquiring confidentially.
Inquiring confidentially. So there's a few aspects of it, of this. But let's go back to the point where we're talking about being pretentious, because obviously revealing your mind in confidence requires not being pretentious, requires being real, being honest, being straightforward. And so, as I said, at least we need some friends that we can just open up to and say, this is where I'm at, this is the problem I'm having. But I want to talk about that a little more, but I just want to also say that it also means revealing one's mind in confidence also means revealing realizations about Krishna. It's not, like a lot of times when we say reveal the mind, we think, well, I'll reveal all the dirt that's in my mind because I need to get it out and start processing it and working with it. But it doesn't always mean revealing the dirt. Obviously, if you have a friend and all they ever do is reveal the dirt, it'll get a little burdensome after a while. So revealing the mind in confidence also means sharing confidential realizations. This is what I've realized. I read this. I was doing this service and this realization came to me. And so that's part of the relationship, is, you know, opening up your heart of realization of Krishna consciousness to others, to share that those jewels with them. So that's part of it. And inquiring also, what is your realization? What is on your mind? What are you thinking? So that's, you know, I think that's more natural. That's more, it's a little easier for us to do. And revealing the mind in confidence, particularly when we have problems, the importance of that is that the problems tend to stay there unless we talk about them. There's a saying in the 12-step program, you're only as sick as your secrets. So if you want to keep everything a secret, then you're going to stay sick. But if you can, you know, go to someone and say, this is a problem I'm having, I need to discuss with someone, or I need someone to just listen and advise me in some way what I should do. And then just, you know, open what's there, what you're feeling. Now, a lot of times we're feeling things which are not Krishna conscious, so it's embarrassing. This is, I'm feeling envious towards this person, and this person's a wonderful devotee, when they're honored, I just can't stand it. And I know they're being honored for what they are. It's not artificial, but I just can't stand it. It drives me crazy. Then you want to, you know, be open enough with someone that you could reveal such things that you might feel are totally perverted or outright asuric, demoniac, you know, totally in the mode of ignorance, but that's where you're at. So you want to get it out.
Yeah. The funny thing about not revealing secrets is that one starts to think that I'm the only one who does this. and then the funny thing about revealing secrets is that you discover that actually, you know, everybody's the same. You know, we're practically all on the same boat. It's a fact. And I found it so important to have somewhere or someone that I can just say everything to, really everything. Because if you can talk about it, then there's hope. You know, Kali, I was thinking that Kali really likes isolation. He likes to isolate people. He likes secrecy. And that's where things can really fester when they're kept inside. So the relationships where you can inquire and, you know, reveal the mind, just they're a lifeline, completely a lifeline.
This is a really important point, the point you made about we think we're the only one with the problem. And so how do we understand that? Well, I think it goes back to the point of pretension, or at least if devotees aren't pretending, when we're associating together, we're always associating in a very Krishna-conscious environment during kirtan or class or some festival. So everybody's obviously on their best behavior. It's just, you know, it comes in that environment that we're coming to the temple. So we're coming to act as best we can, as devotionally as we can. And so it may appear by seeing that other devotees are just maybe have it easier or they're doing better than I'm doing. And my experience in doing seminars is that if you come to a seminar, even a japa workshop, you'll quickly realize in the sharing that we all share the same problems to one degree or another. And even the devotees that don't share those problems, they don't share them because they were able to conquer them. It doesn't mean they didn't have them. They just have really seriously dealt with them. And often that's the only difference between one who has a particular problem and one who doesn't, is that the person who doesn't has really worked on it, has really isolated it, and done everything he or she can to deal with it. And problems are not bad, they're not wrong. That's another thing. A lot of times we'll feel, well, I have a problem, so there's something wrong with me. It goes back to the feeling that I'm probably the only one who has it, or I'm the only one who has it to this degree. So therefore, there's something wrong with me. And because there's something wrong with me, maybe that means I can't even deal with the problem. Because how did it get that bad in the first place? And you know, misery loves company in this sense, at least, to realize that these problems that we have are not unique to us, but are problems that all conditioned souls have, and that anyone becoming Krishna conscious or trying to become Krishna conscious, taking to the process, is going to have to deal with these things. If you read the Madhura Kadambini, it outlines all these different levels of problems. I look at it kind of like digging, and so basically it shows, okay, as you dig down, you're going to see these different kinds of problems, and when you get through those, that dirt is removed, you're going to see another level. And so it's very interesting, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he outlines these different levels, and when you read it, you realize, well, that these are levels that everybody goes through. To get to that gem of pure bhakti, you have to dig out all these anarthas. So, you know, when you're uncovering something, you should understand everybody who hasn't uncovered it must still be working on it. And if they haven't seen it, either they're in denial or they transcended it in another lifetime. But I would say generally they're in denial. They just haven't confronted it yet. So it's the work we all have to do. And so there, and I think the point we're talking about here is that therefore we shouldn't be in any way reluctant to reveal it and fear that others will think, wow, you're really fallen, Prabhu. I didn't know anybody could be that fallen.
I believe that Prabhupada encouraged and requested us to have ishtagostis a lot more than we actually have them in our regular program. Ishtagosti means a practical discussion amongst devotees, a group meeting where everybody talks practical ideas, and
how to apply,
application of Krishna consciousness, and is it actually working? What are my obstacles? And all over the world there's these 12-step groups, which, I mean, it's mundane because Krishna is not there, but still, people who've come to a very, very low point of material life, just by this formula of coming together and being open and honest, you know, huge changes take place in people, and their killer addictions become transformed. You know, I mean, this is a good, you know, we can use in devotional service, the format and the structures can be used. I mean, it's very good to come together with devotees like this and, You know, I would encourage everybody to find at least two or three devotees who you can sit down. I do it. I have a men's group. I sit down with two, three, four, or sometimes five of the same men every week, and we have kirtan, we read Bhagavad Gita, discuss the philosophy, and then we say how we're doing in our spiritual life. You know, any problems, any triumphs, and you know, like that. It's just I look forward to every week. I mean, it's really, really valuable for the practice of Krishna consciousness.
You know, I was once asking a sannyasi what is helpful for a sannyasi, and he said, we need to be close with other sannyasis. Mm. You know, people who are doing the same thing we're doing, who are facing the same challenges we're facing and have very deep, close relationships, because that way, if you're ever in trouble, you ever find any difficulty, there's somewhere to go, someone who can help you, someone who understands you, someone who will support you. So I think what you're talking about in that group is really, it's a support, it's the place to go, and that's what the 12-step programs are. It's people who are dealing with similar issues, who are open about it, who are talking about it. And a lot of what we do in the japa retreats is just talk about japa, talk about our japa, particularly how we're doing with our japa, how we could make it better, where we're going wrong. And often devotees comment, they say, you know, we never really have talked about our japa. And then recently I was in Columbus, Premasindhu was there, we did a 6-hour workshop on sexual purity for men. And so the reason I wanted to do this workshop is I realized that that is a topic which is, I don't say it's taboo, but it's just not something that we talk about. At least we don't talk about it in public forums. It's a private thing. And we all had a chance to talk about our own battles with sexual purity. And everybody felt it was extremely helpful just to get out in the open. And as we got it out in the open, everybody saw, you know, we all have the same struggles. We're all human. We were created with a physical body and a certain male psychology and how that relates to our sexuality. And we just talked about it and how to view the opposite sex in a way which elevates us instead of degrades us, and how sometimes we become degraded and why we become degraded, and looking at different strategies to deal with it. So any problem can be improved or solved just by discussion with other like-minded people. And another amazing thing is that there is a psychologist who teaches counseling as a profession. I think it may be in a seminary college. And he said that the greatest therapy is a supportive community. That's better than any counselor you can get, is having a supportive group. So, we have 5 minutes, is that correct? Oh, his watch says 9. Mine says 5 minutes. What should we do? Okay, does anyone have any questions or comments? Looks like it's time to leave. Time to leave the happy hour, and we haven't even finished the last giving prasadam. What is it? Giving prasadam, and what else?
Accepting and giving.
Accepting and giving sweet balls that you're carrying with you now, from now on. Maybe Krishna.com should sell little sweet ball pouches. And everyone can walk around with a pouch with sweet balls in it. When you see someone, you can just say, Prabhu, can you open your mouth for a second? And throw in the sweet ball. So we hope to see all of you expand your loving exchanges. And perhaps you can try some of these, apply some of the suggestions we've made. And maybe we'll get some stories next week from you of your experiences in your attempts to be more loving in following these six principles. So we'll look forward, if you have some stories, that'd be great, because stories are powerful. You know that book, Chicken Soup of the Soul? They came out, I don't know how many editions they came out with, at least 4, I think, or 5. It was so popular. And it was just stories about people doing wonderful things, and then all the stories touched the heart. So If you can have some, if you have some stories of how you touched another's heart, that will touch our heart. It's very purifying. And in my forgiveness workshop I did a few weeks ago, I started out the workshop by reading many, many stories about forgiveness, about great acts of forgiveness done by apparently ordinary people, and had this tremendously powerful effect on the audience. And I realized that there's a tremendous power in stories, because stories are real. It's people like you and me doing sometimes superhuman activities becomes a great inspiration, or superhuman activities of kindness and generosity and forgiveness and tolerance, and becomes a great inspiration. So we look forward to hearing some of your stories. Thank you very much for listening and watching, and we will see you next week, same time, same station. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Jai. Yes.